loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we take a look at the crisis engulfing the Trump White House following the publication by the New York Times of an anonymous op-ed article last night from a senior Trump official who described that there is a group, a network within the Trump administration that's trying to limit Donald Trump's actions until the end of his presidency by one means or another. And then it's Thursday, so we continue our weekly series every Thursday with Paul Wright and Kevin Gastala called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Yulia Skripal, the daughter of Russian double agent Sergei Skripal, said at a press conference in the UK this morning that she hopes to return to Russia after her rehabilitation is completed following the nerve agent attack on she and her father. Meanwhile, the government of Theresa May has accused the Russian government and two alleged Russian intelligence officers of carrying out the attack. Next, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will host his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in in Pyongyang on September 18th. The scheduling of the meeting was immediately praised by President Trump and heartened observers who are looking for movement on the issue of North Korea's peace with South Korea. Then the Jerusalem Post reported yesterday that the Israel Defense Force had been arming Syrian rebels in an effort to keep them engaged in a fight with Iranian troops. The Post took the article down after a complaint by Israeli military censors. And then eight demonstrators have been killed so far this week in protests in southern Iraq against corruption and inadequate basic services. This major unrest comes as the new Iraqi parliament convenes and heated negotiations to form the next government intensify. And finally, North Carolina's congressional districts have been found to be racially gerrymandered, but that isn't stopping state authorities from conducting one more election based on that district map anyway. Meanwhile, a federal prosecutor appointed by Donald Trump has issued two broad subpoenas seeking voter registration and other data from 15 million North Carolinians. Civil rights groups say the move is an attempt to suppress the Latino vote. And in other headlines, German Interior Minister Horst Seehofer said yesterday that were he not a minister, he would join the recent fascist rallies in Chemnitz as a citizen against immigration. He also said, quote, "I understand when people protest, but it doesn't make them Nazis," unquote, despite some in the crowds using the illegal Hitler salute. A panel of India's High Court yesterday unanimously abolished the ban on gay sex in India, a 157-year-old law originating from when India was under colonial rule by the British. Gay rights activists said that the law made for continued extortion and prejudice against the LGBTQ community there. In an historic move, Ethiopia has reopened its embassy in Eritrea. Eritrea fought a bloody war of independence against Ethiopia, and the two countries have been bitter enemies ever since. However, the new Ethiopian prime minister has taken dramatic steps to improve relations. Seven Senate Democrats released an open letter calling on the Department of Justice to investigate Rudy Giuliani for possible violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico was the principal author of the letter. The allegations revolve around Giuliani's relationship with the president of Romania. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the crisis engulfing the Trump administration. The New York Times took the unusual step last night of publishing an anonymous op-ed editorial piece. The opinion piece was reportedly written by a senior Trump administration official, and it talks about chaos in the White House, a president who is unhinged, and the worry that many of the most senior officials in government, that the president is a danger to Americans. The fallout, especially that emanating from the White House, has been dramatic. Here we have, I don't know if we're going to call it the deep state, or as the author says, the steady state, but people within the administration actually trying to bring down the Trump presidency. We're joined from California by Joe Loria. Joe is editor-in-chief of Consortium News. And we're joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Ted, Joe, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gosh, I mean, just when we thought the story had reached its apex yesterday, the op-ed came out. This was inside the Trump administration, somebody who the New York Times said was an anonymous but senior or top Trump official, basically saying that Donald Trump is a failure and should not actually be president, and that people inside the Trump administration are trying to contain the damage of a Trump presidency until such time as Trump leaves the presidency, quote, one way or the other. Anyway, Ted Rall, pretty dramatic.
Very dramatic. I don't think we can call it a deep state kind of attempted coup, because the deep state traditionally refers to sort of long-term non-political appointees, people who survive from one administration to the next. And this sounds like a political appointee of the Trump administration. But it is nevertheless shocking. And there's also some, aside from the political implications, there's some serious journalistic questions. The New York Times brazenly violated their own published ethics guidelines, which about the use of anonymous sources, which is supposed to be for very important stories that would not otherwise get reported, and for people who are facing whose lives might be in danger if they were to go on the record. Neither of those seem to be the case here. Trump might be unhinged, but I don't think he's going to kill the source here. It also doesn't sound like this story, that certainly doesn't seem to reveal anything that we didn't already know from for example, the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, that came out a few months ago, or for that matter, the Omarosa book.
Yeah. Joe Loria, is this anonymous person a person? Is this real?
Or is it multiple people even?
I think it's probably real. I don't think the Times would have made this up, as Trump has tried to say. I do think, though, speaking on the journalistic question, that this would have been better done as a story reported in the news columns. And this person could have been an anonymous source. If that person didn't want to speak to a reporter, didn't trust them, they could have given this op-ed to the newsroom and have them write it up as a story. And then it could have been a legitimate news story. But to present it this way as an op-ed without naming who it is extraordinary and troubling, even to members of the New York Times reporting staff, who are worried that they have to try to find out who this is. And the answer to that question is down the hall in the editorial department. So it's a very bizarre situation. But to just comment on this actual piece, we'll get into the substance of it. I just want to, first of all, dismiss the sickening nature, the nauseating nature of some of this stuff about putting the country first and we're all Americans and rising above politics. This is an extremely political hit job on the president by someone inside his administration. So that to give us all this patriotic stuff is really something that I found stomach churning. I will put aside. But the thing is, the guy who wrote this got it all backwards, because the things that he says the country needs protecting from are the things that he praises, such as deregulation and historic tax reform or robust military. These are the great things that Trump did. But we got to save him from better relations with North Korea and Russia, because Trump shows a preference for autocrats. You tell me, anybody tell me, what administration since Eisenhower has not cozied up to autocrats and dictators around the world, from Marcos to Pinochet, et cetera, et cetera. So that is just another bit of rubbish right there. But it's his trouble. The troubles are that for this person is that he wants better relations with Russia and China, which is Russia and North Korea, which are the only two points of anyone could really agree with on Trump. Everything else, particularly his economic policy, is wrong. But this person has praised that. And he also, the really interesting thing that we learned from this piece is that Trump was reluctant to expel Putin's diplomats after the Skripal issue that you talked about on your show yesterday. So Trump didn't want to do that. He's being forced to do things he doesn't want to do. This is the insight that we could get from this piece, as we did yesterday when we talked about Woodward's book.
Oh, I agree with Joe Loria. I think that if Donald Trump were mentally ill, if Donald Trump were temperamentally unbalanced for some kind of medical or physiological reason, it would have been in this piece. It wasn't. What was in this piece, as Joe points out, was that the author simply disagrees with Donald Trump's policies and the way Donald Trump is trying to implement those policies. He's not a professional politician. He has no experience whatsoever in foreign affairs or defense or intelligence affairs, and he's winging it. That doesn't make him mentally ill. That doesn't make him crazy. It doesn't make him dangerous even. It just makes him different.
He might be dangerous.
It's possible, but not for mental health reasons.
I totally hear you on this. And anyway, let's go back to Ted. I mean, this article from Inside, a political appointee, that's what you're suggesting, Ted, from within the Trump administration, is denouncing Donald Trump. He asserts, or she asserts, whoever wrote this, that there has been a secret effort underway from senior Trump officials to more directly control his presidency until it comes to an end, quote, one way or another. The author also said the high-level grouping has secretly weighed the possibility of removing him from office. For now, the official says they are, quote, continuing to work inside the administration to limit the destructive impact of Trump for what they say is the good of the country. The article asserts many Trump appointees have vowed to do what we can do to preserve our democratic institutions while thwarting Mr. Trump's more misguided impulse until he is out of office. Now, the question that I have, there's a couple questions. One is this person, and this is a discussion we had in our editorial meeting, is this person know that they're going to be eventually outed? Does this person have a book in the pipeline? Is this person going to be revealed after they've already proclaimed themselves to be one of the many unsung heroes who are being chastised by the media, but who are actually the adults in the room secretly working to restrain Trump and save the country? Is it that person, or is there actually a cabal within the Trump administration similar to the Stop Trump movement of the 2016 campaign that was a Republican-led effort to really undo the presidency? And that's what's going on. In other words, is it that kind of a deep, profound, historic type split within the existing administration? Anyway, your thoughts, Ted?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I see a Venn diagram here. I think this is clearly written by one person who obviously feels that he or she has some allies within the administration, and more than implies that he or she is speaking for a number of people who believe that the president is temperamentally unfit. The person talks a lot about the rambling meetings over which Trump presides, which is, that part surprised me. I mean, he's a experienced businessman for many decades. I would expect him to be pretty well organized. But you know, let's take this at face value. I mean, to your question, I think in this day and age, you have to assume that this kind of knowledge is going to get leaked. He will be outed. I mean, I have to think that there's some enterprising linguistics forensicist who is running published pieces and speeches by members of the Trump White House and non-White House Trump administration officials through a database, comparing it to this piece, looking for linguistic ticks. There's already been some speculation that Vice President Pence, which I think is an absurd idea, because of the word lodestar, which appears in the word in the piece, and apparently in lodestar is a relatively uncommon word, but Pence uses it a lot. I mean, personally, if I was writing an anonymous piece, and I would try to use some misdirection, and I would use words like that, linguistic tics that belong to other members of the White House team, people who I did not like. And Pence would seem to be more like decidedly from the Trump side of the Trump administration. So I think the person has to expect they're going to be outed unless they're a complete idiot, and it doesn't sound like they are. The person has to know that they're kind of going to want to be like the Edward Snowden of the anti-Trump resistance. They're going to want to come out smelling like roses and be viewed as, or maybe the Alexander Butterfield, who revealed the existence of the White House tapes, the beginning of the end that eventually led to resignation or impeachment.
Well, are we anywhere near there, Joe, the beginning of the end? This just seems to get more and more bizarre as we go through this this administration, or at least this term, I should say. Does it get worse than this, or is this the point where a whistleblower comes out and says, all right, the emperor has no clothes?
Well, I think it's going to get worse than this. And I think that a whistleblower is going to come out and say the emperor has no clothes. That's essentially what this article is all about, although we don't know who it is yet. Yeah, I agree with Ted that it probably isn't Mike Pence, because the New York Times would have really been out of line to publish a piece by knowing that it was the vice president and the extreme self-interest he would have in getting rid of Trump. So I don't think it is Pence. I do also bring out Mike Allen in his Axios Daily emails, which is, by the way, sponsored by the Boeing company, which one should note. He says that he's learned three or four other members of the administration have agreed with this op-ed and said they wish they had written it. And then he goes on to say that he quote these people saying that he's paranoid. What did Woody Allen say about being paranoid? Just because people are out to get you doesn't mean you should be paranoid. I mean, he's worried about this because they're out to get him. And I do think this person may not be in the deep, so-called deep state, but we have seen a long history since right before and after now the inauguration till now of intelligence agents being quoted in the newspapers as unnamed sources trying to destroy Trump and his presidency. And we have the Peter Strzok story and all of that. So this fits right into that. There is a rebellion because he wants to get close to North Korea and China and bring about diplomatic solutions. And that is the real problem here, because he was great on the tax breaks to the billionaires. I mean, this is such a political document, and they don't want him in there because of Russia. The really key part of that story is Russia.
Yeah. Ted Rall, what about another theory that these guys are rats and the ship is sinking and they perceive it's going to be sinking? And so they make the point that they are the, as they put it, or as he or she puts it in their article, the unsung heroes saving the country from within, inside resistance fighters, the underground, the subterranean forces for good against the evil captain. Or is it the other narrative that they're willing to even go down with the boat to prevent the evil captain from going forward with his demonic plans? Anyway, what do you think?
First of all, I think that both the left and the right have a different memory of the French Resistance than I do. I don't remember any members of the Vichy cabinet working from within to undermine Marshal Pétain. And no, they shot at Nazis and Vichy guys. That's what the Resistance did, and they got killed for their trouble. It's kind of an insult to the memory of those people that the Democrats have appropriated the term Resistance for this, and now apparently so have some Republicans. I think in terms of the motivation, we're looking at someone who is, look, it's from their own point of view, is it going to be self-interested? Of course it is. And they're going to want to come out of it smelling as nicely as possible. The curious part is, of course, when do they expect to be outed? It has to be, it's a when, it's not an if. And then the question is, how does that play out for them? I think it's also worth considering this at face value. What if things are exactly as this person describes? What if the president really is temperamentally unsound and should be removed under the 25th Amendment? Then you have to ask, well, what about the alternatives here? Rather than penning an anonymous piece for a major newspaper, whatever happened to the Cyrus Vance approach? He was the Secretary of State under Jimmy Carter, who resigned in protest of the failed Iran hostage crisis rescue mission that he disapproved of happening. He told the president not to do it. The president did it over his objection, and he resigned. Resigning on principle seems to be something that just doesn't exist anymore. And I think it's unconscionable, not to mention, if you're a true patriot, you're far freer to say everything that you know after you leave the administration. You resign under you make a big splash. You call a press conference. Maybe you write an op-ed then, or you write a book. But you're going to have the credit. I'm enough of a journalist to say that it's hard to take someone seriously who's not willing to go on the record.
Yeah, and this is not real whistleblowing.
It's really not. And Ted makes an important point here. The tone of this piece was the president is dangerous. I'm going to tell you why the president is dangerous, but I am so important to keeping this government functioning that I'm not going to reveal my name. Take my word for it. It's terrible in the White House, but thank God there are people like me who can keep things functioning.
And Joe Lauria, knowing what we know about Trump, this will drive and has driven Trump crazy.
Absolutely.
There's absolutely, in terms of chaos in the White House, this doesn't tap things down. And if you're secretly, quietly trying to restrain Trump from his worst impulses. This would have the exact opposite impact because, of course, Donald Trump would be super on guard against anybody doing just that under these circumstances.
Well, exactly. And if you, the piece mentions that they thought about the 25th Amendment and getting him out because he's mentally unstable, but they dropped that idea. What does that tell you? They couldn't prove this. But so maybe writing a piece like this will have him melt down even further so they can get him out. So that's absolutely right. They knew how he would react to this. There's no question about that. But this person that John pointed out is standing on ceremony saying that they're protecting the country from what he is doing to the nation. What is he doing to the nation? He's trying to improve relations with foreign powers. And he, what he did bad to the nation was the tax break that the guy loves. If whether he, this gets worse, as John asked before and I didn't answer, well, it'll up to the November election, obviously, if the Democrats can get a majority in the House, they will impeach, but probably the Senate wouldn't convict. But there's definitely a drive to get him out one way or the other. And this is another way, this op-ed, extraordinary op-ed piece.
Yeah. Ted, again, I want to go back to the question, does this do serious damage to the Trump administration? We have, you know, we had the book come out by Bob Woodward. And Bob Woodward, by the way, just for our audience, and I want to repeat this. I mean, the reason he and Carl Bernstein were able to break the Watergate story, the real reason is that Mark Felt, who was number two at the FBI, the guy who was right below J. Edgar Hoover and who was upset about a number of things, mainly that he didn't become the director, he was the one who was deep throat. He was the one who was giving Woodward and Bernstein the trail so as to be able to, you know, go after Nixon. And it seems to me that Woodward has always been the voice of this or that intelligence agency as they carry out what they want to carry out in politics in Washington. And we know that the intelligence agencies were predisposed against Trump for a whole variety of reasons, not because they were Republicans. I think they decided that Trump would be bad for the United States to be president of the United States, but they were clearly after Trump. What do you think about the timing here? Did the Times obviously had this anonymous op-ed. They released it the day of Woodward's book. Is it like trying to, you know, the denouement of Trump right before the midterm elections, for instance?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that because I was hoping to bring that up regardless of what you asked just then. The timing is incredibly suspicious. I mean, look, we don't know. I mean, it's entirely possible that it's a coincidence. It could just simply have been in the flow at the Times op-ed page. But I have to think that anything that is this high level that probably was only vetted through at most perhaps one or two editors plus the publisher at the Times, that something that sensitive, the release date, the timing of it would be crucial, and that they liked the idea of the fact that this would follow the Woodward book. You know, all things Woodward bring attention to the Washington Post, the Times' historic rival. So this would kind of wash the Washington Post away from out of the headlines, and it did happen. And it also has the effect of being the 1-2 punch, right? Like first, the Trump is already reeling and it's like, but wait, there's more. So psychologically, it had exactly that impact. Could be a coincidence, but I would bet it was timed. You know, the release date of the Woodward book was not classified. And going to, Bob Woodward's history as a establishmentarian, that goes all the way back to the Watergate reporting. There was a rift between Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward back then. And Bernstein leaned far more left than Woodward. And that Bernstein was always the more anti-establishmentarian figure of the two. And guess which one has had the better and bigger career ever since.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Good point.
Joe Loria, we're winding down. I want to read a couple sentences again from this anonymous op-ed and get you to comment. Although he was elected as a Republican, the president shows little affinity for ideals long espoused by conservatives. Free minds, free markets, and free people. I think those are just meaningless, euphemistic words for regime change and ripping people off. But anyway, at best, he has invoked these ideals in scripted settings. At worst, he has attacked them outright. In addition to his mass marketing of the notion that the press is the, quote, enemy of the people, President Trump's impulses are generally anti-trade and anti-democratic. Don't get me wrong. There are bright spots that the near ceaseless negative coverage of the administration fails to capture. Effective deregulation, historic tax reform, and a more robust military, and more. But these successes, Joe Lauria, come in spite of the president. I mean, this shows the fundamentally right-wing character of this opposition, and yet the liberals are chomping at the bit. Well, liberal doesn't mean anything anymore. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I pointed out that line earlier. That's what he thought Trump had gotten right, and that's what anybody really on the left would think he got wrong. And what he's gotten right is Russia and North Korea. So this is an unbelievably right-wing attack against Trump. But as you said, the mania against Trump is so strong right now that it doesn't matter who's piling on, whether it's Woodward, whether it's the New York Times, whether it's a right-winger like this person. The idea is to get Trump. They will use Woodward. By the way, I wanted to make this point that he often said that it's been said, you know, you don't use a source as an axe to grind. This guy and Woodward sources clearly have axes to grind. We don't look at the career aspect of government people so much. We think careers have to do with the private sector. But this, who knows why they want Trump out? Who knows why Woodward wanted to quote someone, or someone wanted to talk to Woodward that would hurt Mattis, to get Mattis out because maybe he would get a promotion because Mattis is blocking him. There's all these things that we don't know what the motives are behind an article like this or a book like Woodward's. It surely isn't because America is this wonderful place that's bringing democracy to the whole world and Trump is screwing it up. I mean, that could be immediately dismissed, all of that rhetoric, that patriotic rhetoric. This is a, and we're not defending Trump here on this program, as we often say, as you often say, and I often say, but this is just an attempt to get him out for reasons we don't always understand, but I don't think they're for the stated ones, except when it comes to Russia. He didn't want to kick the diplomats out. He wants better relations with North Korea and Russia. These are the only two instances where the Democrats should be applauding Trump for going to the summit with Kim Jong-un, the way the New York Times and Mike Mansfield and Ted Kennedy applauded Nixon when he went to China. That was when we had political maturity in this country, when Democrats could praise even a Republican president who they hated, like Nixon, if he did something that was for the benefit of the country and the world, really. But that's not where we are today, obviously. This is so partisan, and this is about career and power, and they want to get Trump out, even though he's doing the bad things he's doing, they're praising, and the good things he's doing, they are decrying, and that's why they want him out.
30 seconds left. Ted Rall, you wrote the penned or drew the comic, the graphic novel about Trump's life. I was reading it over the weekend, by the way. Everybody should actually read it. It's a great, great book. And are you going to do a novel about Mike Pence? I mean, are we going to look at a Pence White House?
Well, I don't know. Mike Pence is an interesting figure. It depends on, you know, biographies are always about, is the story interesting and would people buy the book? So who knows?
Would he be worse than Trump?
As president?
Yes.
I would say no. He'd probably be as impotent as Gerry Ford was after Nixon.
Wow.
We're going to leave it there. That was the voice of Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. We were talking to Ted Rall from New York. You can also see his stuff at rall.com. That's R-A-L-L. And we were also joined from California by Joe Lauria. Joe Lauria is editor-in-chief of Consortium News. Stay with Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on the show.
I know that we've talked about this for the last 2 weeks, but I want to talk about the national prison strike again. Paul, you have written about this in Prison Legal News magazine. This prison strike has taken on a life of its own. It's actually begun to succeed to the point where prison authorities in different prisons around the country have begun what's basically a manhunt looking for leaders of the strikes. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think this is also the thing, too, is that, you know, the notion that, you know, the prisoners are anything but slaves. And I think this is the thing, is that the big thing that prison officials fear the most is any type of leadership among prisoners, and that anyone that objects to basically being treated as a slave or as a chattel animal of some sort. And so now the big thing is that they've been doing is seeking, you know, who the leaders are that have been organizing the strike or calling for it and things like that. And, you know, I think that's part of the, you know, I think this is part of the whole part and parcel thing of what happens, you know, within, you know, within prisons is that, you know, prisons are really about destroying people. It's not about, you know, no one's trying to, you know, rehabilitate prisoners in the sense of, you know, making them productive members of society and ensuring that they're able to do things on their own, think effectively. It really is about the infantilization and of the individual and also the destruction of the individual. And I think this is part of it is, you know, and the key thing is the system of slavery that exists in our prisons and jails in this country. In a large part, it depends for its success upon the slaves accepting their status as slaves. As soon as the prisoners object to being enslaved and aspire to more or think that they're entitled to more, that's when the whole edifice starts to crumble. And prison officials know this, and part of the thing is anyone that's a leader, they think is a leader, harshly repressing them so that other prisoners are intimidated and terrorized into not, basically not standing up for themselves and allowing themselves to be enslaved. And I think the big thing is that this is not new to this. This is not something that's particular to the prison system in this country. I mean, this is something that, whether it's plantation slaves, concentration camps, any type of forced labor, or forced enslavement of people relies on these same tactics. And it's the same thing, whether it's Spartacus being crucified for leading a slave revolt or Nat Turner being hung for leading a slave revolt on a plantation, it's always the same. Anyone that speaks out or organizes against slavery needs to be viciously and ruthlessly suppressed. And that's what they're doing.
Kevin, you and your colleague Brian Sonnenstein have a piece at shadowproof.com in which you talk about how, I don't even know how else to say it or to put it, but how natural allies in the media have actually not been allies regarding the prison strike. And I'm talking specifically about the Marshall Project. I go to the Marshall Project website all the time. I think its research is generally excellent. They're well informed, but they're just wrong on this prison strike issue. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. And I think we raised this a little bit on the show, so I'll try to tread new ground so we don't repeat what I said last week. But, you know, in this case, you have the Marshall Project, and up to this point, they have only done two pieces of coverage on the prison strike. They've done one where they insinuated and used a lot of innuendo to suggest that the media was allowing organizers to exaggerate how many people are participating and how many prisons are actually part of the prison strike. They believe that people were miscounting the extent of this strike that has been called historic. So in 21st century speak, that would be called concern trolling. And it has no value to struggles for social justice. And then they interviewed a warden, a former warden, about his views on the utility of work strikes. And the warden actually said that these sort of stoppages, this sort of resistance typically doesn't work. So this is the coverage that the Marshall Project, which is supposedly on the side of criminal justice reform, is putting forward. And in fact, I just very briefly want to say that the communications director for Marshall Project got very angry at us and came after Shadowproof. The whole newsroom, we hear from this reader who gave us an email between her and Carol Boggart, who is the director of the whole Marshall Project. You know, they were very upset that we had challenged them, and they were upset that we published a private email from their director because it was meant to be private. And then the other thing was that they were just upset that we were suggesting to them that they were wrong in the way that they characterized media, and we got into it too with them because they were upset in the way that we characterized their lack of sourcing, the fact that they didn't go to prisoners in the prison system. And then in fact, we did kind of misread what they were doing. They did talk to a prisoner, but when they talked to this prisoner, what's really fascinating to me, John and Brian and Paul, is that they only used five words from this prisoner. It went big real quick. And I mean, to me, you talked to this person probably for 15 or 20 minutes. There's no way you only got this person on the phone for 10 seconds. And then they did that at great risk. All of these prisoners who are talking to any journalists are putting themselves at great risk, as can be seen by these news stories about facilities going after the organizers.
Right. And Paul, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, you're in touch with prisoners all around the country in that they write to Prison Legal News magazine. Talk a little bit about the retaliation that some of these prisoners face. Now, this strike has gone on for, what, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks now. It's generally about low wages, these slavery-type wages, poor conditions, bad medical care, not being able to vote. Talk about the retaliation that they're facing.
Basically, a lot of these prisons have been placed on lockdown, and I think that, you know, in some respects, I always find it ironic, is that, you know, faced with organized resistance from the prisoners, the prison response is, well, just lock everyone down, and that way no one can say that they maintain the facade that they are in control, because it's the prison officials deciding to lock things down. It's not necessarily, you know, the prisoners that are shutting the prison down, it's the prison officials that are doing it. And so, you know, so they like to do that. But, you know, but for a lot of this stuff, though, it's, you know, the retaliation, it's omnipresent, it's always going on. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, and this also goes based on my own experiences when I was in prison, is, you know, I was a prison activist when I was in prison as well. And if you've ever seen Casablanca, where Claude Rains plays the police inspector, and his underlings ask him, well, who should we arrest? And he says, arrest the usual suspects. And, you know, and a lot of what happens literally in prison is they do, you know, even if they don't know anyone's doing it, it literally is round up the usual suspects. And I would find myself being thrown into administrative segregation, supposedly for investigation, even for stuff I had nothing to do with. And it's, okay, so you sit in solitary confinement for, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever, and then, you know, that's when they conclude and they're convinced that maybe you didn't have anything to do with anything. But then if they do, even if there is no evidence or proof, you're still sitting there. But a lot of this is about, you know, destroying any type of leaders, setting an example, regardless of whether anyone's innocent or guilty or whether they are organizing for better conditions or not. The big thing that gets across to prisoners is if you stand up or you speak out, you will be hammered down and crushed. And that's the overwhelming, you know, that's the overwhelming thing. And, you know, and I think it's important to note, though, is that, you know, you see this giant manhunt for, you know, the organizers of this prison strike. And, you know, let's keep in mind, though, that, you know, that with a work strike, it's a nonviolent protest. People are withholding their labor that they're not being paid for anyways. This isn't about criminal activity. This isn't about, you know, no one's being taken hostage. You know, no one's being blown up. And you see the lengths that they use to crush, you know, any type of peaceful, you know, any type of peaceful protest or peaceful dissent over the enslavement of and human rights violations that people are being subjected to. And then what I think is interesting is if you contrast this about media coverage, for example, in other countries about, okay, if people are protesting enslavement or low wages in, say, Burma or Myanmar, or Syria or Iran or places like that, it's, you know, viewed as being heroic and, you know, people are standing up for their human rights and everything else. But when it's American prisoners that are protesting their slavery and trying to change their status as slaves of the state, yeah, that is a very different response.
Kevin, I want to talk a little bit about Ohio, because from everything I've read, whether it's in Prison Legal News magazine or at the Marshall website or wherever it is, it seems to me that Ohio has among the toughest, harshest punishments for prisoners who engage in things like these prison strikes compared to any other state in the country. Can you talk about Ohio and the kind of retaliation that prisoners are facing in Ohio?
Well, yeah, just so for a specific example, we have the case of Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan and the fact that, you know, you lose your phone privileges just for being somebody who's talking about the strike.
For a year.
Yeah, for a year. You lose it for a year. You know, you have preemptive punishment. This isn't just this sort of thing isn't just about, we know you did this, you talked to the press, or you were involved in planning this organizing. And there's a pre-crime nature to the way in which warden officials or prison corrections guards or whatever, you know, go after and target people and then take them out so that they can't participate in these sort of organizing efforts that are ongoing. And so I think you're right. And then limiting access to publications, being able to make it harder for them to connect and then read material about what's going on in the outside world cuts them off and isolates those individuals and makes it harder for them to organize. I want to say something really quickly just related to what Paul was addressing, because there's something that's really stood out in my mind about the prison strike while this has been unfolding. As I know from my coverage of the Guantanamo Bay prison, that there were hunger strikes down there. And one of the things that the military immediately wanted to do is to, there was a shift when Obama was president. You know, for the longest time, Carol Rosenberg at Miami Herald was actually running a tally of the number of hunger strikers when there was, it's a few years ago, is the most recent round of strikes. They were tallying the people who were participating, and this was a public figure that could be followed by the press. But the military became aware that this was probably helping prisoners within Guantanamo to continue their strikes, because it made them, they knew the public was paying attention. So the military decided they were going to stop telling the press how many people were participating in the hunger strikes. It's the same thing that's going on today when we look at the different prisons where the spokespeople deny that there's anything going on in their facilities. They don't want anybody to think that there is actual resistance going on, even as they simultaneously ramp up security measures and lockdowns and use them to basically control an insurgency. I mean, this is counterinsurgency playing out within the prison system, and they're using that playbook. And it's a very similar playbook, in my opinion, to what happens at Guantanamo.
It's so interesting, John, that the government is doing this. It says a lot about the actual nature of the government, about the totalitarian character of it. Yeah, we get to vote every 2 or 4 years for politicians who will probably oppress us for the next 2 or 4 years. But the spread of information from people who are desperately struggling for basic rights. And, you know, I was just reading a book. I was reading a book about the Russian Revolution about a month ago. And one of the things that came out, and I was looking at all the different tendencies and factions within the Russian revolutions. There were the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and the social revolutionaries and the constitutional democrats. And the thing that was noteworthy about all of them, the thing that they were struggling against, was that that the czarist autocracy made it illegal to report a strike. If you reported a strike in public, then you were going to be sent to prison yourself or sent to Siberia, because the information, the knowledge about people striking was crucial for progress, because the strikers needed to know that people were hearing them, and other people needed to know that there was other activity, that they weren't just atomized and isolated. So it was this critical point. And as a matter of fact, the Russian revolutionaries all formed illegal underground organizations, not really to carry out insurrection, but to be able to report on strikes. In other words, to tell these basic truths. And here we are in 2018, a representative democracy, not a czarist autocracy, but the oppressed working people, in this case prisoners, are facing the same problem, and the rulers understand the same challenges. Anyway, that's my rant. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, this is the reason I started Prison Legal News in 1990, was so that people in general and prisoners in particular would know about struggles that were going on. And actually, I kind of modeled it on Lenin's What Is to Be Done. That was actually, you know, one of the things that, you know, got me going on that, was, you know, wanting to be able to do that. And you know, and I think that's a critical thing, is that, you know, when the media portrays a thing of, you know, well, everything is fine, you know, there is no you know, there is no resistance, or, you know, there is no, everyone is happy with the status quo, then I think, you know, that's a very different message or note than saying, you know, well, you know, people are unhappy, people are rebelling, people are doing something. And, you know, and I think that's kind of the, you know, those are, I think, kind of the differences of, you know, where we wind up at.
Let's move away from the strike then and talk about a couple of other issues that have cropped up over the course of the week. Kevin, there was an interesting piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about conditions for mentally ill women at a jail in Fulton, Georgia. You know, we've talked about conditions before, and they tend to be absolutely awful. This was unusually awful. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, so it's a suit that's being filed on behalf of these prisoners. And I think the reason why I'm attracted to this and want to raise it on the show and address it is because, it's a letter. It's a letter calling for change. There's no official lawsuit yet, but I imagine it could develop into something. But what we're talking about here are really poor, extremely poor people who do not have, and by extremely poor, I mean do not have $200 or $500 for bail. So they remain in prison, in jail, on low-level misdemeanor offenses. And while in there, you have people who, in general, before they were incarcerated, had medical problems, were suffering from psychological issues. These people are now the responsibility of these facilities, but clearly they don't want to do anything to take care of them. They just want to warehouse the mentally ill and treat them like garbage, basically. And in the course of this, you have horrible things going on within. I mean, this quote from this lawyer, I have to read this because I can't say it any better than her. You see caged people screaming incoherently with the overwhelming smell of feces in the air. It's barbaric. We can't permit these kinds of conditions to become normalized in our criminal legal culture. I mean, obviously, we know from talking about these cases that this happens all too often in jails, but I agree with her that it's repulsive that people are treated like this.
Absolutely terrible. Paul, you've written extensively in Prison Legal News about this kind of issue. In fact, there was an article that I based an op-ed on not too long ago about a private prison in Mississippi, where it's not uncommon to have rats crawling across you while you're sleeping in your bunk. There was a rat that was found drowned in one of the drink dispensers in the cafeteria. I mean, this really isn't so unusual, is it?
No, it isn't. And actually, you know, one of the things I want to comment about the Fulton County Jail is that the litigation and our friends at the Southern Center for Human Rights, they've been suing the Fulton County Jail for literally decades. This litigation has been going on for at least 20 years, if not more than that, around the basic conditions. In fact, Prison Legal News, we've sued the Fulton County Jail for banning books and magazines as well. And it's just a real cesspool. And some of the other things to note is the corruption and the brutality that's inherent in the American criminal justice system. It's really hard to distill out, you know, quickly and easily. But I think in some respects, the Fulton County Jail is almost the epitome of this corruption and brutality. They've got these barbaric conditions now. These conditions have been in place for literally decades, despite, you know, decades of litigation and court oversight trying to do it. But one of the things that's interesting is that a couple of years ago, one sheriff, for a period of time, five sheriffs in a row left office in handcuffs on corruption charges for being corrupt in their administration of the jail. Not the brutality, not the deaths, not the medical neglect, but for being corrupt in terms of taking bribes and kickbacks and stuff like that. And one sheriff who got elected on a anti-corruption platform was literally murdered by his predecessor, who sent a sheriff's deputy over to his home to gun him down. And so, yeah, this is the ambiance we're talking about at the Fulton County Jail. And it's been longstanding. And I think that what a lot of this illustrates, though, is the total complicity and encouragement that this barbarism gets from elected officials in this country. And the fact that at the legislative level, the executive branch level, no one is concerned about doing anything to correct or stop this. And in fact, they aid and abet it. They vigorously fight any efforts, however modest they may be, from the court system to try to do something about it, and it just goes on and on.
We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we are joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. We're talking about criminal justice issues, which we do every Thursday on the show. I want to talk a little bit, Kevin, about Pennsylvania. This was such an odd issue that popped up this week, and it's how Pennsylvania prosecutors are now pursuing charges against people, criminal charges against people who fall behind on their rent-to-own payments. Now, there are rent-to-own places in poor neighborhoods all across America. You can rent a couch or a TV or a microwave oven or whatever it is if you don't have the money to buy it outright. But people are poor in these areas. Poor people rent furniture and televisions. And now if they fall behind, they can go to prison. What's that all about?
Well, yeah, I think what's important about this is they're not talking about misdemeanor charges. We're not talking about something that you can probably escape in your life if you would fall behind on payments. These are felonies that people are getting under this theft of leased property law that the state apparently has. And these rent-to-own companies, it's like Aaron's, or I suppose even like Rent-A-Center, these businesses are working with these district attorneys to criminalize. And as the appeal did coverage of this story, as they put it very succinctly, it's used by rent-to-own companies to turn the criminal justice system into their debt collector. And frequently, we've talked about the different ways in which the criminal justice system is used to act as a debt collector. I mean, in this case, it's just incredible. I mean, the thing that they highlight here is how this 23-year-old man had a bench warrant. He ended up having to pay $25,000 on bail. And again, the crime that we're talking about here, nobody died, nobody was hurt, nobody was ever in danger because of this man. In fact, the crime was that he fell behind on payments for a bed and washing machine. And someone is going to jail and someone is paying $25,000 in bail because they miss, you know, paying a few hundred dollars in a monthly payment for a washing machine.
You know, this story reminds me, as we approach September 9th, which is when the prison strike is supposed to end, which is the first day of the beginning of the Attica Rebellion in September 9th, 1971. The prisoners in Attica, one of their slogans was, "American prisons are concentration camps for poor people." In other words, the crime is really poor. You may have committed a crime of survival. Maybe you were involved in robbery, or you were selling drugs, or some part of the underground economy in order to live. Crimes of survival, basically. But here you have people going to jail, not for committing a crime of survival, but really just being poor. I mean, it's a dystopian view, but it seems like an expanding view. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, and I think this is also part of the key things is that, you know, I'm one of the people that believes that the whole purpose of the criminal justice system in this country is to operate as a tool of social control to contain poor people. It doesn't really have any other purpose. And I think we've seen this increasingly and with stuff like this, where historically it's one thing for a police state to wait for citizens to commit crimes, but I think that the beauty in a lot of respects of the American police state and why it's grown to size that in sheer numbers, and both sheer numbers and percentage of the population, cages more people than the Soviet Gulag at the height of the Stalin era in the 1930s or Nazi Germany in the 1940s did, is because they're caging people for things that aren't criminal offenses. You know, in this case, falling behind on your payments is basically these private companies are using the prosecutor's office essentially as a strong arm debt collection agency. And we've seen lots of examples around the country where companies will literally pay the prosecutor's office to use their letterhead to try to intimidate people into making payments. And so on the one hand, they do that. But, you know, on the other hand, there's this whole slew of offenses. You know, after Ferguson, it turns out that lots of people that are languishing in jail in Missouri, it isn't because they committed a criminal offense. It's because of things like they didn't mow their lawn. In some cases, the people were disabled and poor, so they couldn't mow the lawn themselves. They couldn't hire anyone to do it. So they get a citation and a fine for having an overgrown lawn. They can't pay that. Then they wind up being incarcerated and caged for literally an overgrown lawn. And this scenario plays itself out over and over and over again around the country, and it gets to the point where you've got thousands and tens of thousands of people being caged, not for any criminal offense that they've committed or not for any violation of the criminal law, but for basically poverty laws and running afoul of the government and its role as a debt collector. And one of the things we've reported on in Prison Legal News is on any given day, there's at least 50,000 people languishing in prison or jail for no reason other than the fact they're too poor to afford to pay the child support obligations or the child support they've been ordered to pay by the courts. And yeah, that's 50,000 people. That's a prison population the size of the entire prison population of the state of Michigan. And that's what's languishing. These are the people that are languishing in prison. And I think this is also one of the things to keep to think about, you know, for your listeners, is that the United States has 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prison and jail population. So why does America cage 500 times more of its population than any other country in the world does today?
And you know what? Let me interrupt you there. I'll add, too, that Congress is partly responsible for this. Well, they're wholly responsible at the federal level because they create 50 new crimes per year legislatively. 50 new crimes a year. That's things that were legal last year that are illegal. They're felonies this year just because Congress decided to do that. I'm sorry that we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gustala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com, and he's the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back with a lot more. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.